I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. It's 2029. The U.S. is in decline, and Philadelphia is being occupied by United Korea, the world's superpower.
As the dollar tanked, our debt to North Korea spiraled. Unemployment rocketed, and the country was on its knees. The failing government defaulted on the debt, and the North Koreans made their decision. Every piece of technology they'd sold us had a back door. They turned off our military with a single button press.
That's a clip from the trailer to a new first-person action shooter video game, Homefront: The Revolution. It's a dystopian vision of the future set in the birthplace of America, where a resistance group has organized to take down the Korean military. This is the latest game from Dambuster Studios and Deep Silver Games. Well, we wanted to know what this game is about and why it's set in this city, and asked Hazit Zallah to join us, studio head of Dambuster Studios and game director for Homefront: The Revolution. And Hazit Zallah, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. All the way from sunny Nottingham.
Well, we're nice to have you here in our fair city that you have taken over in this new video game. Why did you choose Philadelphia?
I chose Philadelphia because, in kind of video games, New York had been kind of LA and San Francisco. And a lot of these kind of places have been done a lot of times, and we wanted something that was iconic but different. And then if you also kind of look at our kind of story and the idea of our brand, is this the premise of our kind of story in fiction is this idea of the story of the Second War of Independence. And so when we were kind of researching and having a look, I mean, Philadelphia being the birthplace of independence and a kind of city that basically we could really kind of make our own and make unique within the kind of video gaming, culture, it just seemed like the perfect kind of fit for us.
So well, Yeah, and I'm sorry to say, Hazit, we don't have the greatest phone line. I'm going to carry on. We may have to call you back and get you on a better phone line. Perhaps you at Dambuster Studios can figure out how to solve all of our telephone problems in our modern world. But I'm curious about, I know you came to the city for about a week and looked at various sites in the city. What were you looking for?
Well, we initially came over and we wanted to do a field trip, and it was myself, the game director, we had our art director and our lead artist come over for a field study, and our kind of then publisher at the time, THQ, kind of organized this trip so that we could really get a proper feel for kind of Philadelphia. These days you can get so much kind of information from the internet, but actually being there, seeing the architecture, seeing the main site. So we spent a whole week in kind of Philly and Atlantic City as well. So but we spent 3 days kind of visiting places like City Hall, Fairmount, the kind of university.
Well, and I have to say, I was looking at your video game and I recognized some of the row homes. Was that of particular interest to you? And that's a very Philadelphia thing.
Well, this is one of the things we noticed straight away when we got there, and you kind of look at the unique architecture. In many ways, very similar to kind of the style that you have in the UK. So these classic row house buildings and architecture. And then also other kind of unique things we saw were kind of lots of murals and just things that basically we could kind of take inspiration from and kind of build into our game.
Well, we heard that kind of voice of God part of the trailer for this video game. Looking at it, I mean, clearly it is a very dark view. It's raining. There's debris. There's graffiti. There is surveillance. There are the military from Korea that have taken over Philadelphia. Why did you choose Korea? Because we think of that as the Hermit Kingdom. I mean, clearly it is not a powerhouse when it comes to technology, but in this video game, it is.
Well, The way we conceived the story or rationalized it was to actually kind of build out an alternative history. And to make this scenario plausible, we started asking ourselves about an alternative history, a kind of what-if scenario, and a kind of a fork, some certain event that happened that changes the course of events in such a way to make this scenario kind of possible. So what we have is this idea that imagine if you know, Will, that someone, some technological visionary, someone like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs, was actually born in the East, was born in Korea, and you know, and then we extrapolate from there this idea that this kind of whole technology and industry build up in the East. So we have this idea that the Silicon Valley becomes this idea of, you know, we replace it with the idea of a Silicon River that's based in the East. And we talk about this company that grows up from it, Apex, which I guess in many ways is equivalent to something like Apple or Google or kind of one of those mega kind of companies that have grown up, technology companies. And we take that and we kind of extrapolate from kind of that end of the fiction. And then we also kind of look at America and here this America kind of has been kind of embroiled in very kind of long and bitter wars. We see a kind of a massive stock market collapse and, you know, the American economy tanking. We see an increasingly right-wing kind of reaction to that and this reliance on this Apex technology from the East. And this country, the United, sorry, Korea has become united, but it's actually the company that's actually bigger than the country. And so we have the idea that the KPA, who really are kind of owned and financed by this company, Apex, have become the people who actually come over to America.
Well, and that's how I think of fascism, is when countries and companies unite, in a sense, that's what you're dealing with.
Yeah, and that's very much what we're doing. So we kind of take this idea that this huge company kind of becomes so powerful and then kind of unites other countries, and then we have this kind of extrapolation of this alternative history leading to the premise of the game.
You know, I have to say, Hazit, and we're hanging on here telephone-wise. I'm not exactly sure what to do about it. We will carry on, but it's not the greatest phone line. What I don't play video games. I'll confess that up front here. And I was just blown away by just the cinematic quality of the game. I mean, forget whether it's violent or not, or their weapons or not, but just looking at that place where animation and live action seem to be conjoined, if I can put it that way. I mean, sometimes you see that in 3D movies where you can't tell, is that real? Is that animated? And you certainly get that quality in this video game. Were you going for that?
It was right from the outset that we wanted to make a AAA game of the highest quality. We have this very strong, rich narrative running through the game, and to really kind of push the fidelity of that, we really, you know, spent a long time making sure that all our kind of and all the production techniques we use are the ones that they use in the latest films. So, you know, we go to kind of you know, motion capture studios, we go to the top places, we hire out the top actors, we get all the state-of-the-art kind of video cameras that kind of capture all this data, and we import it into the game. And with the increasing power of the new kind of consoles that are out in the market, we're able to kind of really recreate very, very lifelike representations.
Well, you're the director. I mean, a director the way a movie director is a director?
Absolutely. I've just come off this morning from a mocap shoot, and indeed what we do is we write a script, and then we get the guys to kind of do a table read, and then we get them to act it out, and we sit there and we work with them, we look at the scene, and then we kind of adjust it as we go. So absolutely, directing the scene, directing the camera, very much for, you know, exactly the same as you would do in any film.
Well, one of the revolutionaries, as I understand it, is a, or was a pirate radio broadcaster. Do I have that right?
Yes, yes. Our main protagonist, or the kind of hero that everyone aspires to within our world fiction, our kind of Che Guevara figure, is this guy, Walker, who is known as the Voice of Freedom.
And how long did it take to create this video game?
Well, we've been working on Homefront: The Revolution now for just over 5 years, would you believe? So it's been a journey.
A good journey, a difficult journey.
Well, with any very long project, I guess it's taken its time, and we've had our few kind of ups and downs along the way. But largely speaking, we've been kind of working on it, and it's just really been about kind of pushing and you know, maximizing the quality and making it as compelling as a product as possible.
Well, Hazrat, we're going to have to say goodbye to you in about a minute or so. This is really guerrilla warfare, and it's called Single Player Story. For those of us like myself who don't play video games, what does that mean?
Well, I think the key thing really is that a lot of the games in the market are all centered around games where you play as kind of special forces, military people, people who've been trained all their lives to be soldiers, super soldiers, sci-fi kind of soldiers. Here in our game, we do something completely different. We look at the wars that are around in the world today, and we look at what is kind of quintessential kind of guerrilla warfare. And this people, ordinary people, everyday people, nurses, teachers, engineers, who picked up arms to protect the liberty of their country, and they're fighting for their country, and so there's a whole kind of set of tactics that guerrilla fighters use, where they know their land and their terrain, and they have a different kind of protocol and engagement. So, you know, they're often using very kind of improvised weaponry, and they're always going for quick hit and run strikes. And so it presents itself as a very different way of engaging in combat.
Well, Hazrat, we have to say goodbye to you. I regret that, because I would love to talk more, but not the greatest phone line. Hazrat Zala, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Studio head of Dambuster Studios, game director of Homefront: The Revolution, a video game set here in Philadelphia. We're going to take a very short break and then talk more about video games. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Just said goodbye to Hazrat Zala. We were talking about a new video game called Homefront: The Revolution, a rather dark view of Philadelphia. The year is 2029, and a united Korea, the world's global superpower, has occupied the city. Well, we wanted to talk more about the world of video games, and we have two guests who have joined us. Patrick Klepek is a senior reporter at Kotaku, co-host of the Match 3 podcast and the podcast Till Death Do Us Part, joining us by Skype. And Patrick Klepek, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Jake Muncy, contributing writer for Wired and the AV Club. And Jake, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hey.
Hey, nice to have you with us. Well, a very jolly crowd. Let me open up the lines to our listeners, especially those those of you who play video games, we want to hear from you. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Patrick, you were listening in. We had this terrible phone line, unfortunately, with Hazit Zala. But what do you make of this video game, Homefront: The Revolution, again set here in Philadelphia?
Well, I think it reflects a trend that's happening increasingly in video games where as the people that have played video games most of their lives are now making those video games. And those people want to see video games evolve as a medium. They look at them as art in the same way that a lot of generations look at music and film and literature. So I don't think it's a surprise that we're seeing games try to tackle more serious subjects, things that are more political, as a way of understanding video games as a medium that is, you know, slowly but surely, you know, getting a little bit closer to film and literature.
What do you think, Jake?
Yeah, I would agree with that absolutely. And one thing that I would note about the Homefront series, I think, is really interesting and salient to that is the way that it's a series that riffs off of a lot of ideas that have existed and we've seen film before. Like the first game was very much sort of a Red Dawn thing going on.
Red Dawn.
Yes, and I think that it's a really interesting and exciting time in the medium right now. And if you're someone who's curious about the medium, now is a very interesting time to jump in because there are creators doing a lot of exciting and creative things and trying to make things that resonate with what they care about and with what they think other people care about. And I think, Homefront is interesting in the way it situates itself around these very serious sort of things.
Patrick, let me go back to you. This is something I said to Hazit Zala, which is I don't play video games. I know people who do.
Sure.
But I was just, I have to be honest with you, I was just blown away by the cinematic quality. And perhaps I've just been, you know, off not paying attention. Is this new? And it does look like some of the things that I see in movies, 3D movies. I was thinking of The Jungle Book where you can't, I mean, the animals just look so real. But this video game had a reality to it that was really compelling.
Yeah, you know, video games, if you paid attention maybe as you were growing up in the 70s and 80s, and then suddenly take a look at video games now in 2016, you know, the leap they have taken in terms of graphical quality and the fidelity, they're so much closer to the animated films or the computer-generated graphics you see in a superhero film, except that you get to be a part of that experience. And I think that's what's fundamentally different about video games from any other creative medium is that the person holding the controller is an actor, is a participant. And so as the fidelity increases and it becomes more and more realistic, it introduces a lot of really fascinating scenarios for both creators and players as it gets closer and closer to reality because it allows it to reflect subjects that aren't abstract, aren't strange. They're pulled from our reality, and yet we get to be a participant in that. And that's really exciting and scary, and we're not sure quite what all that means yet. You know, I think what's amazing about video games is that there's so much that's undefined. You know, so much about other creative mediums have been iterated on and imagined for hundreds or thousands of years. Video games are so new, and we just don't even know what they are yet, really.
Well, Jake, let me turn back to you. And I know that the sort of notion of the world of indie games is not a new one. I mean, this has been developing over the last couple of years. But what do the indie games bring to video games that weren't there before?
Is that to me?
Yes, to you.
Yes. All right. Sorry. Yes. I think what. Okay. So for listeners who aren't super familiar with independent games, basically what they are is they are games made by people who don't work for major studios, big corporations. These are people at home working on their computer, small teams, maybe just one person. And I think what they bring to the table is just a vast wealth of experiences and perspectives and ideas that weren't in the medium before. I think, like Patrick said, we're at a very exciting time where games are capable of taking you anywhere and taking you there with a high degree of fidelity and faithfulness to what it might actually feel like to be in those places and doing those things. And I think what the independent games movement adds to that is that you get these worlds and these things to do and these experiences to have from a wide variety of perspectives that you might not have gotten, you know, 15, 20 years ago when it was much more expensive and difficult to get over that initial hump and start making games.
Well, and it sounds like, I mean, in many ways, Patrick, it's like indie movies or indie bookstores or, you know, any of the indie cultural things that are going on. It seems like video games are following suit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not quite the equivalent of films or books yet, where it's just, you know, with films, you can just pick up a camera and you can shoot something. With books, you can just, you know, pull up a computer or get a pen and paper. But we're moving closer to that direction. You know, what was different about video games for the last several decades has been, in order to make a video game, you either needed to have a high level of technical competence or access to enormous resources. Games were mostly made by huge teams with hundreds of millions of dollars. And while that's still true and those games will continue to exist, what's changing is fundamentally what you need in order to create a video game. So those barriers are being broken down, where you don't necessarily need to be an expert programmer. You don't necessarily need to be an amazing artist. There are tools in place that have lowered that bar. So the amount of voices that can create video games is increasing. And that's incredibly exciting because it means new kinds of stories, new kinds of ideas, things that people that, you know, maybe grew up with games, were a programmer, they may not think of this type of game to make. But if someone comes in with these new tools, they have the ability to bring their ideas to the culture. And that's a really exciting thing for the medium.
Jake, let me go back to you. And I was looking at this game yesterday, Cybele. I know that you like it. As well, and I was reading that it's part of what they call autobiographical games. Is there a way you can describe that to our listeners?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I would say biographical games. The connection I make to Cybele, which is made by this woman named Nina Freeman, who makes really compelling, largely autobiographical games that are very easy to pick up and play. I think of like confessional poetry and writing that's about, you know, taking a part of a creator's psyche and experience and reflecting it to the audience. What Cybele is, it's a game where you play as a young Nina Freeman building a relationship with a man online while playing a sort of big online game together. And so you play this game in her shoes and you go through this experience with her, building this relationship of seeing what it's like. And it's a very human and sweet and sad and shares, you know, an authentic part of this young woman's experience that might be difficult to get in any other way, because you get to sit in her chair basically and go through her computer and be a part of her world.
Well, and it's taking this idea of memoir, autobiography, and taking it one step closer, because you, in a sense, are her.
Absolutely. And that's something that is a new frontier for video games, I think, largely because, as Patrick was saying, for such a long time, video games have been these things where you need massive amounts of money and time and hundreds of people to make them. And so video games with really personal, intimate voices were hard to come by. That just wasn't really the goal and wasn't really an easily accessible thing in those kinds of circumstances. But now that it's possible for Nina to sit and program a game on her home computer and put it out in a couple of years, and it's, you know, about her life.
Let me just reintroduce the two of you. Yeah. That's Jake Muncy, contributing writer for Wired and the AV Club. Also with us, Patrick Klepek, and he's joining us by Skype, senior reporter at Kotaku, co-host of the Match 3 podcast and the podcast Till Death Do Us Part. Getting a taste of some of the interesting developments in the world of video games, and you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.com. WHYY.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Patrick, before I get some callers in on the conversation, another video game I was looking at, and I know this is one that you like, it's called Firewatch. I was looking at the trailer. Describe this for our listeners.
So Firewatch is a first-person game, which if you're familiar with any of the games where you hold a gun and shoot, you know, it's where you kind of take the perspective of the person and walk around. And it's set in Wyoming on you are a volunteer for the summer in which you are meant to basically sit around and see if there are going to be
fires,
the forest
right?
is going to go up in flames. Yeah, you are fire watching. It is a pretty to the point. And it's you would normally think that's going to be, you know, a game where you're running around and putting out fires and it's really exciting and it's an action game. But what Firewatch is actually about is the deteriorating relationship between the main character and his wife, who is going through, let's say, something traumatic, so I don't have to spoil exactly
right.
what's going on. But the story then becomes about your relationship with a woman who is in another Firewatch tower. And so, you know, you kind of climb around, you do, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but it is really actually a story about relationships, about growing older, about what it's like when people who are close to us leave us. And these are themes and ideas that are just beginning to be explored in games. And your ability to inhabit one of those characters and walk around in their shoes, I think, allows you to experience those emotions, to experience empathy in a way that is a little more difficult or differently told in other mediums.
I thought the voice acting was really good.
It's incredible. It feels just like you're listening to two people just talk regularly. And, you know, that's one of those things where, you know, games are advancing every single day in directions that make them feel more and more natural and more cinematic, that I think allows people that maybe have dismissed video games in the past to kind of see that, hey, these things are interesting. They're doing fascinating things. And the closer they are to cinema, in some ways that makes it easier for some people to kind of get into it.
Let me read an email from John. He says, most of what's seen on commercials for video games is not the game. It's the cut scenes. I find that annoying because commercials like this give no insight to the game experience. If the guests could talk about that, it's frustrated me for years, even decades. Do you share, Jake, do you share John's frustration with how these games are promoted or sold or advertised?
Yeah, I can validate that frustration. It's hard because, you know, video games are a difficult thing to advertise because, like, you can't play a commercial, obviously. So it's hard to market them in such a way that it communicates the experience effectively. And I think what a lot of big game companies do to answer this is they go to make something that is just as explosive and exciting as possible that doesn't necessarily reflect the experience. And if you're, you know, if you're a consumer that wants to be able to see what they're actually going to get, that can be, you know, pretty hard. But I guess that's why there are, you know, writers like us.
fair enough. Let me read a question from Scott. He says, this is about Homefront. Is Homefront an open world game like Grand Theft Auto, or is it more like a boxed in game? Patrick, can you respond to that?
My understanding is that the new Homefront is sort of a mixture of the two, in which the player is given a number of options in any given scenario, but it very much has a story that you're playing and you're progressing through that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. But games, generally speaking, are trending towards giving players more and more options in bigger and bigger spaces, and Homefront definitely reflects that trend.
A question from Anthony. What are their opinions on downloadable content and its impact on video game sales and quality? Patrick, let me toss that back to you.
It's a really interesting quandary. These days, when you buy a video game, you don't necessarily get the whole video game when you walk home from the store or you download it through your computer or your game console. You know, normally if you walk home with a new Captain America, like, you've got the movie.
Right.
You know, there's
right.
nothing else. Whereas video games these days, they've extended the life and the price of these games where, you know, if you want to play the whole story, if you want to see everything the game has to offer, you may pay $60 up front. And then you may pay as much as $40 for what they call a season pass. It's, you know, gives you access to all the extra content that is coming out for that game, potentially a year or 2 years throughout the life of the product. And it's been a very controversial addition to video games in the last 5 to 10 years. Some games use it well, some games use it poorly. But it's one of those things that I think consumers are starting to have an increased reaction to as they feel that maybe they're not getting their money's worth.
Jake, do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely, I do. I mean, I feel like it's a mixed blessing because definitely there are situations where you're not getting your money's worth and where you feel like, you know, you like parts of the game were locked away and are being sold back to you piecemeal, and that's incredibly frustrating. But I also think that there are opportunities there for levels of polish and creativity to emerge that might not otherwise when developers have time to keep working on things and put out new parts of the game and new iterations of things about the game that interest them and engage players after, you know, the launch. Like Patrick said, they increase the life of the game, which can be very exciting thing.
Sure, sure. About a minute before our break here, to you, Patrick, I don't have the figures at my fingertips, but it seems that video games are more profitable, or people spend more money on video games than they do going to the movies. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, the metrics are kind of all over the place, but I think it's undeniable that video games have become an enormous cultural force in which they stand toe-to-toe with Hollywood or any other medium, and I can't imagine that's going to change because I think more and more people are just getting older that grew up playing video games, and video games aren't weird to them, and that's going to be something that's going to be part of their lives and their children's lives.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about what's new, what's interesting, what's developing when it comes to the world of video games, and I do want to talk about virtual reality after this very short break. That's Patrick Klepek, senior reporter at Kotaku, again, co-host of the Match 3 podcast and the podcast titled Till Death Do Us Part. Also with us is Jake Muncy, and he's a contributing writer for Wired and the AV Club. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Tell us about the video games that you have been enjoying. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Patrick, let me ask you about The Witness. This is another video game that I was looking at yesterday. In fact, looking at the trailer, and to be honest with you, I looked at the trailer. We had a caller that was complaining about that. I didn't know what the game was about. But what can you tell us about The Witness? I mean, it was beautiful, I have to say. But what's this game about?
This one is a lot of games that we're talking about, Homefront and Firewatch, like a very story focused. And with The Witness, there is a story, but it's very much a puzzle game. It comes from a designer named Jonathan Blow, who became famous for making another puzzle game called Braid a number of years ago. And with The Witness, the trick to this game is that you're stuck on an island, and there are these little boxes everywhere that have these line puzzles, and they don't seem to make any sense. There is no text anywhere telling you, here's how the puzzles work, here's what you're supposed to do. And the game teaches you the rules of the puzzles by actually solving the puzzles themselves. Wow. So you'll start out with very simple puzzles where you're moving just a dot from left to right, but then that will complicate, that will morph, and that'll give you a new rule set. And you learn that by solving these puzzles, and then you go over to the next set of terminals, and suddenly, oh, right, I just did this. Now I know how to do that. And the game spends 25 hours essentially building this complex matrix of puzzle rules that are all taught by solving or not solving various puzzles on the island. And it's a really clever trick that you wouldn't normally see, because you think puzzles and how to play a game, there's instructions, here's what to do. And this is a game that says just trust that you're going to learn by playing. And I think it's largely successful at doing that.
Is it difficult to do, though? I mean, it sounds pretty challenging.
It's really hard. Yeah, I haven't finished it.
Oh, really? How many hours have you spent on it?
I play 10 to 15 hours, but my job usually demands me to jump from game to game pretty quickly. And so if I run into a roadblock, unfortunately, I usually have to move on to the next one.
Jake, let me go back to you and tell us about No Man's Sky. This is also a pretty interesting game on the horizon, if I can put it that way.
Yes, I think on the horizon is the perfect way to describe No Man's Sky. It's coming out this summer, and it's a space exploration game. And the premise of this game is that you have this seamless, vast universe. And what the developers have done is they have created an algorithm that generates this vast universe automatically and randomly. And so it's this like infinite, or more or less infinite. So they have said so far, universe of planets and aliens and strangeness, and you're a dude in a spaceship, and you go and you can go anywhere, and you can land on a planet, you can fly to a different planet, and it just looks beautiful and huge and fascinating. And it's a game that I think looks like it's going to be really accessible to people who don't play a lot of video games, but who are drawn in by that wonder of exploration. So I'm looking forward to it.
I mean, Patrick, sounds like the universe, right? Infinite and beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely. That is the hope.
Patrick?
Yeah, and what's really amazing about No Man's Sky is the fact that you're playing this game simultaneously with thousands or tens of thousands or millions of players at once. And when you journey through the universe, if you discover a new species, if you discover a new planet, you get to name it, and it becomes yours. And it's not just yours in your game. It's yours in that universe that is shared by all of these players. So if I discover Patrick, which I plan to discover, as possible when it comes out. When someone finds that planet, they're going to be able to say, "All right, Patrick found this planet," and then they don't get to. You have made that yours, and so the slowly but surely, people get to fill out this constantly growing galaxy, but they get to make it their own. So as infinite as it is, a personal touch to it, because you'll notice that other players have been there.
Well, you know what, Patrick? It sounds like your Skype is breaking up. Perhaps we can call you on your phone and get you back on the show. And again, Patrick Klepek and Jake Muncy, our guests in this hour of Radio Times, getting a taste of what's up in the world of video games. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Jake, there's a question about the open beta of Overwatch that Blizzard has released. I have no idea what that question is about. Can you take it?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Overwatch is a multiplayer shooter game, and with a lot of very vibrant and interesting characters. There are cowboys and space marines and a giant robo gorilla with a hammer. It's great. And I have spent a little time with it. I think it's an excellent game. And the open beta is just an early test of the game that's going on right now that players can jump into on, I think, PlayStation 4, Xbox, or PC. And I think it looks to be a really vibrant, energetic, and fun experience. And so if that made sense to anybody and you want to try it out, I would recommend it.
That's fair enough. Jake, how much time, I mean, I guess it's part of your job is to know about video games. Does that leave room for video game playing when you're not at quote unquote work?
I try to enforce a work-life divide and my wife tries to enforce that as well, but it's hard. And one of the distinctive things about video games that's very exciting if you're a player, and very challenging if you're working on it, if you're working in them, is that they take more time than movies or music or whatever. And so as a writer, I spend a lot of my time just having to sit down and play video games. And sometimes that means that my not officially work hours are still spent playing whatever that thing is. So I have, the experience I need to write about it.
Well, let's talk about virtual reality. And Patrick, it looks like you're back. Is this the hot new thing for 2016, virtual reality and video games?
Well, they're definitely making a big push for it. You know, whether it's actually going to be successful remains to be seen. But there are three different headsets that are launching this year, one on PlayStation and two on the computer. And they're all very expensive. You know, it's $300 on PlayStation and $500 to $800 if you're buying it on your computer.
Wow.
But what VR promises is an opportunity to, you know, be part of worlds even more so than video games already offer. You know, it's an opportunity to look around those places, if you use these, some of these controllers that allow you to actually pick things up and walk around in these spaces. So rather than, you know, moving an analog stick to walk around a room, you're actually walking around that room. I recently did a demo where I was walking around my living room and I was picking up a stick and throwing it around the room, and a robot dog was picking it up.
Oh,
and
my goodness. Wow. It's here, right?
It is, and it just allows you to get immersed in these worlds in a way that's different than a screen you're just looking at. And I think, you know, I'm not sure it's going to replace, you know, the television, but at least in the short term, it's a very compelling, different type of experience.
How about for you, Jake? Have you tried it out?
I have, yes, and I would agree with what Patrick is saying. What I would say is that is it a thing for 2016? I would say not unless you have the money to spend on it, or you're just a huge VR enthusiast. I think what's exciting about this year is this is the year when these headsets are being released to the public, which means that we're going to see a lot more experiences being made for them. People starting to figure out, okay, what are games actually going to look like on these machines, and what sort of other things can we do with them? And I think in years when prices start to go down, and that trickles down to, you know, a normal person might be able to want and afford and understand what's happening with this, I think that will be a really exciting time, and I'm looking forward to that.
Patrick, it sort of reminds me of 3D movies. You know, 5 years ago, that was the hot new thing, and there were all these attempts to turn everything, it seemed, felt that way for a while, into a 3D movie. And some of it worked, some of it didn't work. And I wonder whether for video games it will be a similar kind of thing, virtual reality, that you need a narrative. It has to be more than just a gimmick.
Yeah, it's definitely possible, but I think you have to look at, you know, what happened with one of the earliest VR headsets was purchased by Facebook for several billion dollars. And so, you know, the leading social network that dominates a lot of our lives, a lot of the lives of people in the world, is making a big bet on virtual reality being a significant force. I think what Facebook is looking at is that games are an early application of virtual reality, because there are spaces that you play in and walk around in and interact with. But virtual reality is probably something that doesn't really hit the mainstream till it's something that, you know, goes in your contact lenses, or looks a little more stylish than putting a big brick over your face.
Is that what it looks like, a big brick?
Oh, yeah. There's no way to not look completely goofy right now with it. You know, when you're in there, it's an amazing experience, and you don't feel like you have a brick on your face, but everyone else looks at you with a brick on your face.
And, is it so compelling you could imagine moving into that world, that world of virtual reality, Patrick?
Well, you know, I always use my wife as a great test case for all this stuff, because she's kind of into games but isn't, you know, paid to do it and made it a profession like I have. And when I showed her this virtual reality stuff for the first time, you know, it's pretty expensive. And so I was like, can I spend the money on it? And then she spent 10 minutes in it, and she was like, where do we put the credit card down?
Oh, really? Wow. Because so, of what? It's just that new and compelling and exciting?
And it's really something you can't quite understand till you do it yourself, you know, because what's compelling about it is the fact that you're in that space with the headset on, and you feel like you're part of that world. And there's no way that I can tell you that through words. There's no way that a trailer is going to convey that to you. It really is one of those things that until you sit down and do it yourself, it's just going to sound like a bunch of crazy people are telling you that VR is the future.
Yeah, especially if you have a brick on your head.
Exactly.
For those
help.
Of us who live in the real world. Anything, Jake, you want to add to that?
No, I mean, I think he's absolutely right. I think that the reason why I think VR will, you know, whatever the application ends up being, it's going to be here to stay, is because, like Patrick said, the experience is so impressive. I mean, this is a technology that takes all of your visual and audio field and replaces it with another world. Every direction you look, you see that space, and you're doing that thing. And that is just, it's a fundamentally different kind of media experience.
Let me go back to you, Patrick. And you had sent us a list of some games that you like. We talked about Firewatch. Or we talked about The Witness. You like one also called Darkest Dungeon. What is that about?
Well, Darkest Dungeon is this interesting example of a video game that takes a very traditional structure for a game. It's, you know, you get a party of fantasy characters and you go into a dungeon. But what's unique about Darkest Dungeon is that it takes very seriously the idea of mental health and mental illness. And your characters have to deal with those detriments to themselves. So, you know, stress is an actual factor in that game where, you know, you're going deeper and deeper into a dangerous dungeon. That seems like that would probably be stressful. And if you keep impacting stress upon your characters, that's going to make them less capable in order to defend themselves and to defend others. And so it's this melding that's happening in video games is and kind of been a through line in the conversation we've had this morning, is that games are finding ways to take what was interesting about games in the 70s and 80s and 90s and then start melding them with some more serious real-world concepts where, you know, in real life, I feel like you would have to manage your stress levels in
Absolutely.
A dungeon where things are killing you. And so this game does that.
Well, I noticed this game also began with a quote from William Blake, just to kind of underscore what you were just saying there, Patrick.
Right, exactly.
A couple minutes before we have to say goodbye, Jacob, is there a game or even some new technology that is on the horizon that you think our listeners should know about?
Let me think. Well, I'm about to play the new iteration of the Doom franchise when it comes out on Friday, and this is a reimagining of that of one of the first shooter games where you're a space marine in Mars, which is also hell. And it'll be a really interesting test case if you're someone who played games in the 80s and 90s to look at that at the original PC game Doom and then look at the 2016 Doom and see how far games have come and what different sorts of things games do now that they haven't been. And so I think that will be really interesting. And that game comes out on like Friday, I believe.
And Patrick, again, we're almost out of time here, but I think for people that don't play video games, they think of it as, you know, violence and a lot of heavy weaponry. But I think what I certainly learned by looking at some of these video games is it has evolved from that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the line I try and tell people is that, you know, do you judge Hollywood films by, you know, what you see on TV? Because if you thought that was the whole breadth of what was being produced in film, then you would think that Marvel and DC comic films are the only things that are ever coming out. And then occasionally there's a movie with robots like Transformers. So I think what's important to remember is that there's so much happening sort of below the surface that you might not see advertised at you because those are the biggest blockbuster games. Those are the ones that are making millions of dollars. But there is a whole breadth of culture that is happening in video games. And if you kind of wrote them off years ago, I think it's a great time to jump back in because there's a lot of really exciting things happening.
Well, Patrick Klepek, thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Senior reporter at Kotaku, co-host of the Match 3 podcast and the podcast Till Death Do Us Part. Jake Muncy, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Contributing writer for Wired and the AV Club. And we began our conversation with Hazik Zala, studio head of Dambuster Studio and game director for Homefront The Revolution. The reason we wanted to do this program is that there's a new video game and it is takes place here in Philadelphia in the year 2029. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, John Ahrens, and Liz Fiedler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.